you can get consolation from all sorts of falsehoods, but because it's consoling, it doesn't mean it's true.
No. There are a lot of very religious scientists around.
Science. There is no evidence for any kind of supernatural being of any kind.
You think people should not have a choice of what to do with their body?
Anti-murdering the unborn.
And I say to the grown-ups, if you want to deny evolution and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we observe in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need
But
this.
Why should I believe? Well, because it's the truth.
Welcome to Science, Faith, and Reasoning. Thank you for joining us today. We just made a Beast Twitter page if you want to check it out at SFR Daily. And I'm currently programming a website because I am too cheap to pay the really cheap web services to create a website for me, which maybe I'll come across some COVID money somewhere and I'll be able to just pay someone to do my website. But at the moment, that's not the case. Today, I've got a real treat for you. We're going to be talking about a problem I see with a macroevolutionary model. And the title here is, What Came First, Proteins or DNA? So there's, with you think about evolution, in a general sense, evolution just means change over time. And there's two types of evolution. There's microevolution, small observable changes and adaptations that we observe in the environment, that we observe with the creatures of the world. And then there's macroevolution. And I have no qualms with microevolution. I have no qualms with, you know, teaching the ideas of Darwin in a micro sense that organisms adapt over time and they will adapt to their environment, that nature will select the winners and the losers. I have no problem with that. But with macroevolution, we're talking about huge changes, you know, moving from monkey to man type things, or that, you know, chimpanzees and humans share a common ancestor. Obviously, I don't believe that. I believe that we do not evolve into the image of God, that we are made in the image of God. But today I want to talk about a problem with that macroevolutionary model that, you know, humans and monkeys share a common ancestor, or really, we're going to get down to the very root of things. Where did the first living things come from? And, you know, all living things are made of proteins, DNA, and RNA. What came first to make up living things? Was it proteins or DNA? And how does that tie into, you know, abiogenesis, or living things coming from non-living things, and chemical evolution? Now, Darwin actually, he wrote in his book On the Origin of Species, this is a quote he said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, but I can find no such case. Well, my question is there anything that actually couldn't be formed or could not reasonably be formed by numerous successive slight modifications? And we're going to look at an example of that. Now, what's interesting about Darwin is he knew nothing of cellular biology. And that's not to discredit him. With the data he had to work with, you know, he had a very good view of how nature works. And I don't think much of anything he said is untrue. I think he was very accurate in his depiction of that, like we said earlier, that micro, small evolutionary changes and the adaptations of organisms to their environment and how that could lead to speciation. But it's kind of like, you know, with Newton's laws, his physical laws of like orbits and things in the, with a macro scale, those laws break down when you get to a micro scale, when you get to the scale of, you know, quantum particles. And I think that Darwin's theory breaks down when you look at organisms from a molecular view, when you look at them at a tiny view, which is kind of ironic to compare that to micro versus macroevolution. But I think just as Newton's laws could break down or do break down when you get at the quantum level, I think Darwin's laws break down when we get to the molecular level, because there are certain molecular systems that I think cannot reasonably be explained by numerous successive slight modifications. Not that they can't be explained, they can be explained by numerous successive slight modifications, but what I hope to demonstrate today is that the odds of that happening by chance are essentially zero. And we're going to compare that to, you know, how much time we have available for something like this to take place. And we're going to try to show or explain how that would be impossible. So Michael Behe, he called Darwin's ignorance of the cell, he called that the black box, and he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, which is an awesome book where he talks about irreducible complexity. I'm not going to get into the systems he talks about there because he wrote a great book on it, and if you want to read it, you should check it out, but that's not something that I'm going to be talking about today. Today, I just want to talk about the origin of a certain system that undergirds all of biology. And just to give, you know, I'm not some super scientist or a really intelligent person, or even really, I wouldn't even call myself a scientist. I am a burgeoning science fan, I guess you could say. I'm a science teacher. I took more than 30 hours in biology in college. I had a 4.0 GPA, and I'm currently pursuing a master's in biology at the graduate level. And I did do a little bit of research in my undergrad on some plants, and I took some cell biology classes, but you know, I'm no scientist. I wouldn't claim to be one, and I'm not a genius. But I did learn about something when I got to college. So I was a Christian before I went to college, but when I went to college, I was nervous about my science classes leading up to it, because you know, you always hear as a Christian, and my parents like showed me Christian creation videos. We listened to Ken Ham, Kent Hovind. Kent Hovind's kind of the retro Ken Ham. He actually kind of got the whole thing started, or at least back in the day, in the 60s and 70s, he was a young guy talking about how, you know, God created the world, and there's evidence for that. And when I got to college, I had this perception that everything I was going to learn about in my science classes was going to refute my faith and refute the idea of intelligent design, that there wasn't a designer to the universe. But then when I actually went into the classes, I realized that nothing contradicted the creation. There were some perspectives on macroevolution that might be problematic for creation, but there was no actual hard evidence that I saw that refuted at least theism, the idea that there is a creator. And one of the first things I learned about in introductory biology 101, and sadly I never learned about it in high school for some reason, or maybe I did and I just completely just went through one ear and out the other, because when you're 15 years old, you are a kind of an idiot, and I was definitely an idiot. But anyway, we learned about a thing called the central dogma of biology. And if you've been in my classes before, a biology class, hopefully you know what this is. It's basically the idea that DNA, the information system that undergirds all of biology, codes for copies of DNA called RNA. Specifically, mRNA is what we'll be talking about. And then RNA codes for proteins. And then proteins do everything that keeps your body alive. Proteins are the workmen of the cell. So DNA codes for RNA, RNA codes for protein. Protein does everything in your body. This is called the central dogma of molecular biology because it is the central idea that all of life is based off of. It's the central concept. It's the simple process. Every living thing uses these molecules and this process. When you think about how do you transport sodium and chlorine ions in and out of a cell, you need sodium potassium pumps. How do you fight infections? You need to be able to produce antibodies that can attach to those antigens and target them for destruction. Certain foods that we break down in our body are processed by enzymes. You know, how do we replicate our cells? Going through mitosis, how do we make sperm and egg cells? Through meiosis, and proteins are facilitating all of these processes. And those proteins come from a genetic code in the DNA. Now, we can go into a lot of this, and I guess I'll kind of, let me just kind of break down what is DNA and what are proteins. And if you have a pretty good understanding of this, you know, maybe I'll bore you here, and if so, I apologize. But basically, DNA is a blueprint. I want you to think of it as, I like to think of it as a Lego set directions. So when you go to Walmart, because everybody shops at Walmart and we all hang out there for fun, you're going to buy, when you buy a Lego set, it's going to come with a set of instructions. So DNA is like the set of instructions. It's got nice laminate covering, it's got color to the pages, and it's the directions that tell you how to build the Lego set. So DNA is the directions. And RNA is coded for by the DNA. So RNA is a cheap copy of DNA. So you could think of this as you've got 10 people in a room and there's Legos all over the floor. And you want to give all those 10 people a copy of the Lego set directions so that all 10 of them can build 10 Lego sets at once. So the DNA would be the Lego set directions. You would make 10 copies of that on your copier. And RNA is a cheaper copy of DNA. So just like a copy of a primary page that has color, the copy is going to be black and white. And that's kind of what we see with RNA. So it's more of a black and white copy. It's a little bit cheaper. You distribute those 10 copies to 10 people to make the 10 Lego sets. Those people who are building the Lego sets would be ribosomes in this analogy. Ribosomes facilitate the reading of RNA, mRNA, a messenger RNA, to create a protein. And, you know, if I'm getting too far into the details and it's making you like, what's going on, just bear with me. Basically, the whole analogy is just to show you that DNA is the directions, and then the proteins are the Lego sets that are made from those directions. All of life is based on the system, and the system undergirds literally everything in biology. That's why it's called the central dogma of biology, because every living thing has this complex system. And going back to kind of what Michael Behe was talking about, you know, Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, is about how there are certain systems in biology that he calls irreducibly complex. And basically what he means by that is you can't reduce the complexity of the system without destroying the function of the system. And he used an example of the bacterial flagellum. You know, if you take away one of the proteins that is holding the bacterial flagellum to the cell, it'll be released or it won't hold on. Or if you take off the propeller, it doesn't go anywhere. You know, you remove one of these functional units to the complex system, you try to reduce its complexity and you lose the function. And that's kind of what I'm talking about today, but it's not necessarily an issue of irreducible complexity. I mean, it kind of is. But this is a little bit different in terms of the complexity could be reduced, potentially. It could be demonstrated that it could be reduced, but the odds of this system arising by small, successive, slight modifications over a long period of time, it's possible, so it's not irreducibly complex because it is theoretically possible. However, the odds are not in its favor. So going back to this DNA-RNA protein dilemma, you know, you need DNA. Like if you're going to build a Lego set, you need the directions to be able to build the Lego set. But the problem with that analogy is that the Lego set is stagnant, and the proteins that our bodies produce actually do things, and they have a very specific function. And the function of those proteins often is to actually go back and self-regulate and interact with the DNA itself. So the problem that I propose is that you need DNA to make protein, okay? Because DNA codes for RNA, which codes for protein. So if you don't have DNA, you don't get protein, okay? But you have to have protein to be able to even use DNA. And you can't get a protein unless you have DNA in the first place. So do you see the problem here? It's a chicken or egg dilemma. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Eggs come from chickens, but if you don't have a chicken, you can't get an egg. So what came first, the chicken or the egg? And if you say the chicken came first, well then, where did the chicken come from? It had to come from an egg. Same thing with the protein DNA. Where did the DNA come from? Because without proteins, you can't copy or even interact with DNA. And if you say, where did the protein come from? Like if you have protein first, where did it come from? Because you have to have DNA to code for the protein. So it's a huge problem. And we're actually, I'm completely ignoring a major step in the middle here. A major step where you go from DNA to RNA and then from RNA to protein. I'm just going to completely ignore RNA and just act like that part of the system doesn't even exist. To just simplify this hypothetical scenario, to run a couple of calculations to show what are the odds that we could actually create this system, just create a simple protein, one simple protein, and create one simple DNA strand, assuming that is all it took to have a living thing, which is not at all what it would take. Like you would have way more than that. You'd have hundreds, if not thousands, of DNA strands, genes, coding for thousands or tens of thousands of proteins, and it's all interacting with this massive RNA step in the center of the whole process. So that's what's really undergirding all of biology, but we're just going to act like all we need is one DNA strand, one protein. And we're actually going to start with, to look at our calculations, we're going to say one very simple protein, one very simple DNA strand. I know the process sounds complicated, but hopefully the images, if you watch on YouTube, if I put this on YouTube, will help explain. So let's look at probability of getting a functional protein by chance. So if we were to roll the dice, we have, you know, proteins are made of amino acids. If we were to roll the dice to create just a random protein, what are the chances that we get a small, short strand, simple protein? So the simplest proteins are around 150 amino acids. You could have one as low as 100. You can have some up to, you know, thousands of amino acids. So we're going to assume that we have a very simple, that all we need is 150 amino acids in a strand to have a simple protein for life to start. Could we get life from a random association of 150 amino acids? So what are the probability of that? So I'm getting this number from a geophysicist, former geophysicist and a philosopher of science. His name is Stephen Meyer. And I will post the YouTube link on the to his video, on my video, and in the description of the podcast, if I remember, where he breaks down how we get a functional protein. Basically, you have, you know, there are 20 amino acids that code for living proteins, or that are used to build living proteins, coded for by the mRNA. Three RNA nucleotides code for an amino acid. But there's 20 options for every amino acid. So if we need 150 amino acids, there's a 1 in 20 chance of getting the right amino acid at every step, okay? So the way the math works is you would say 1 over 20 times 1 over 20 times 1 over 20, 150 times. That would be the odds of getting, and there's actually more to it, and if you want to watch this video, you can see. But basically, that's how it works, the probability of getting this short protein by chance. So we're assuming here that, okay, we need to get protein first to get a living thing. Well, the math works out to be about 1 in 10 to the 164 chance. That'll be the odds of getting 150 amino acid long protein from chance, assuming you have all the amino acids there and that they're mixing. If you just throw them all together, what's the chance of getting the right protein? The chances of this are so tiny. And to put this into perspective, there are only 10 to the 80 elementary particles in the known universe. And an elementary particle would not even be a proton, neutron, electron. It would be the subatomic particles that make up the protons, neutrons, and electrons. So there's only 10 to the 80 of those particles. Here's an analogy to kind of help you think about this, because it's hard to imagine such a ridiculously massive number. So here's a quote from a man by the name of Fred Hoyle, and he wrote this in The Big Bang in Astronomy on page 527. I just got tweeted. This will be interesting. Oh, somebody liked my tweet. We're going to get to Twitter here in a little bit, because our Twitter page is getting a lot of interaction, so you need to go follow us at SFRDaily. But going back to this quote here from Fred Hoyle, he said, "At all events, anyone with even a nodding acquaintance with the Rubik's Cube will concede the near impossibility of a solution being obtained by a blind person moving the cubic faces at random." Now imagine 10 to the 50 blind persons, each with a scrambled Rubik's Cube, trying to solve or trying to conceive of the chance of them all simultaneously arriving at a solved Rubik's Cube. You then have the chance of arriving by random shuffling at just one of the many biopolymers on which life depends. The notion that not only biopolymers, but the operating program of a living cell could be arrived at by chance in a primordial organic soup here on the Earth is evidently nonsense of a high order. So essentially what he's saying is the chances of getting this simple protein that you want for life to get started would be like 10 to the 50th power of blind people trying to solve a Rubik's Cube, and all of them, not one of them solving it, every single one of them solving it at the exact same time. That's the odds of getting this protein. Just think about that. There's going to be one of those people who is not going to solve it, even if 99% solved it, which would be ridiculous. One of them is not going to be able to solve that Rubik's Cube. That's the chances of getting the protein by chance. Not going to happen. Here's another quote I'd like to read you. It says, Denoy, but this is from an article, Flaws in the Theory of Evolution. It says, Denoy provides an illustration for arriving at a single molecule of life through chance action and normal thermic agitation. So here they try to paint a picture of like an Earth example with many different attempts at once. How long would it take to actually get this protein? So they assume 500 trillion shakings per second. so that attempts, plus a liquid material volume equal to the size of the Earth. For one molecule, it would require 10 to the 243 power billions of years. Even if this molecule did somehow arise by chance, it is still only one single molecule. And that's something I keep bringing up when I have this conversation with people, which thankfully I had the opportunity to teach this this topic, the central dogma, to my Sunday school class. Let's see, what is today? Monday? I taught this yesterday. And it was awesome because I got to talk about how, you know, even if you get one of these molecules, you need way more than that to have a living thing. You don't have living things with one protein. There's like thousands of these things regulating a cell's health. So that's a huge problem. And this here says it would take 10 to the 243 billions of years to get even one single protein. And we obviously don't have that much time. The Earth, from the oldest estimates, is 13.6 billion years. We're not even close to that. That's not even, you put a pin dot on a piece of paper in your living room floor, compare the size of that pin dot to the entire surface of the Earth, and you're not even close. Okay, there's not near enough time. It says hundreds of millions are needed, requiring compound probability calculations, talking about protein molecules and molecules in general pertaining to life, requiring compound probability calculations for each successive molecule. His logical conclusion is that it is totally impossible to account scientifically for all phenomena pertaining to life. And to give credit where credit's due, I will say naturalists do admit that the origin of life problem is a problem. It's a mystery. You know, they don't have necessarily have explanations for this either, or at least any good ones. It's a problem, in their opinion, you know, that needs to be solved. But to me, it just seems like something that's so irrational that it could not have occurred by chance. And that's what the evolutionary model predicts. You have random changes in the environment. If you're talking about DNA, you're talking about mutations, but just anything. You're talking about random changes that occur through whatever means being selected for by natural selection, like the best will be propagated. But you're talking about non-living things that are not reproducing, in turn, and that's what we'll be talking about with chemical evolution. There is no natural selection for what's quote-unquote better, because it's all just lightning hitting a prebiotic soup. Nothing has any necessarily an advantage because nothing is being able to reproduce. So again, the chances of getting a protein, 1 in 10 to the 164 chance. Very, very tiny. Now, protein is coded for by RNA, which is ultimately coded for by DNA. Every 3 nucleotides in DNA or RNA codes for, directly would be RNA, codes for one single amino acid. So the example we used in the functional protein calculation was 150 amino acid chain protein. So if 3 RNA nucleotides code for one amino acid, we would need 450 nucleotides in the simplest DNA strand that would code for that RNA to be able to create this length biopolymer or polypeptide. Now, there is a observed phenomenon known as the wobble effect, where basically the third nucleotide in a codon, or in the 3 sets of nucleotides that codes for an amino acid, the third one in that codon can actually be pretty much anything depending on what amino acid it's coding for. So I'm actually going to take 1/3 of all nucleotides from this and just scrap it. And instead of saying 450 nucleotides are needed, we're going to say 300. So that would leave us with 300 nucleotides that need to be in a specific order to create this hypothetical protein. So the chance of getting that arranged in the correct order would be 1 in 4 to the 300th power, because there's 300 options, 1 over 4 times 1 over 4 times 1 over 4. Or the chance would be 2.4 times 10 to the 181, or to the negative 181. So it's not very likely that you would get a DNA strand either. So just to kind of put that into perspective, you've got pretty much no chance of getting the DNA strand. I will say it's more likely than getting the protein. But you've got pretty much no chance of getting the DNA strand, pretty much no chance of getting the protein. And just going back to that protein calculation, because I did the DNA calculation, and there's no telling if that's accurate. So somebody can check me on that. But I know the protein calculation is legit. So it's 1 in 10 to the 164. So to put that number in perspective, how much time do you think we've had on the Earth or in the universe for this to even occur? So there's only been 10 to the 16th power seconds since the Big Bang of our universe. Okay? The probability of getting the protein, 1 in 10 to the 164th power. So we haven't even had enough time, assuming we had, you know, one attempt per second. There's not been near enough time for a one single short protein to form by chance since the Big Bang of our universe. Now, how many total events? So an event in the universe would be a proton slinging around the nucleus of an atom. Okay, or sorry, an electron slinging around the nucleus of an atom. The nucleus would have the protons and the neutrons. So that's like one event. Okay, how many total events do you think have occurred since the beginning of the universe? There's been 10 to the 139th power of total events since the beginning of the universe. There are only 10 to the 80 elementary particles in the entire known universe. Okay, so just thinking about these numbers kind of puts that probability into perspective. There hasn't even been enough events to make, by probability, one single protein by chance. There haven't even been enough events occurring in the universe. And that's assuming every single event that occurs in the universe is an attempt at building a protein, which the vast majority of all events in the universe are not making attempts at slinging amino acids together to make a protein. And even if they did, if every single elementary particle and every single event that's ever occurred tried to make a protein by chance, it would not happen. If you actually tried to calculate, okay, you got 10 to the 80 elementary particles. If every single one of them at once attempted to make a protein, how long would it take in seconds? Every single particle that makes up the entire universe, okay, if every one of those attempted every second at, assuming they had all the amino acids available, at slamming them together to make this one simple protein, how long would it take to get the protein? The number you get is 10 to the 84 seconds. In our universe, there's only been 10 to the 16 seconds. That is a massive gap in evolutionary terms. Now, there's been a couple of explanations. So people have tried to explain this away. Obviously, there is the admittance that right now, currently in science, there is not necessarily a good theory of the generative, a theory that it would explain how we get things in the first place, because clearly, you know, Darwinism or small changes over time doesn't account for something like this. It can't even begin to explain this, especially when you think about random chance selecting for this functional protein. It's just not going to happen. So a couple of the explanations that I've seen, one is aliens. So the explanation that aliens implanted the first proteins here or the first life forms here, and that would explain away the abiogenesis. There's a lot of problems with that, though. I mean, if you think aliens, you're thinking, okay, where did those aliens come from? Are those aliens themselves made of proteins? And if they are, well, where did that protein come from? Probably didn't come by, you know, random chance selection, because we know that cannot explain the situation where protein comes from. So then you got to have a new theory. And I've seen other complaints with this that, you know, this math doesn't make sense because, you know, whatever reason. And I would just say, show me an alternative calculation based on an alternative model other than that we would assume by Darwinism. And then let's see how that math works out. But I'm not really seeing that, and perhaps maybe I haven't looked hard enough. Another theory would be the multiverse theory, that there are, you know, multiple universes. And even though there hasn't been enough time in our universe for this to occur, because our universe is the 10 billionth universe, it, you know, this one has, just by chance, has the conditions that would allow this to form or to allow a protein to form. And again, the problem with the multiverse theory is it's an appeal to nothing, because there is no evidence for other universes. And it's interesting that this is even brought up in mainstream science and can be legitimized by people, because there is no way to even measure other universes, because by definition, they're different universes. And you have no way of measuring things in a universe you can't interact with. And then thinking about that too, and this is a question someone had in our Sunday school class, where do those universes come from? You know, there's the ultimate problem of the generative. is where I see issues with naturalism or an atheistic worldview. There's just no way to explain where things come from in the first place. And that's the big problem I see with like radical naturalism or atheism as a one-size-fits-all explanation. I just don't think it is sufficient for the world that we see before us, and especially as it pertains to the central dogma of molecular biology. So in conclusion, you know, a question I would ask the listeners here is, at what point does something become so improbable that it becomes impossible? You know, some people would never say never, right? They would never say, oh, it's so improbable that it's impossible, because the fact that it's even a probability calculation shows that it is possible. It just may not be very likely. And I would just say, like, to that critique or to that response, I think that common sense tells us what probability calculations can't. And I want to pose an analogy to you. Imagine there's a person with a water gun that's full, or just a gun that's full of ink. And it sprays out ink letters of the English alphabet on the wall as you spray it. Just random letters, just throws them on the wall. And it goes out in random directions. The wall, maybe it's 10 feet high and it's infinitely long. If this person is running down this wall, spraying this letter gun on the wall, and random letters are splashing up all over the place, do you think this person is ever going to produce a novel, a work of Shakespeare, a poem? Do you think at any point they're ever going to produce anything legible, anything intelligible, anything that you can even read that has any significance at all? I don't think you will ever get anything. The chances of you even getting a sentence is so astronomically small that it's basically impossible. And that's basically what we see with chemical evolution as an explanation for where protein comes from. The chances are so tiny, I think common sense would tell us that is not how it happened. God made it. And if you look at Romans 1, 18 through 23, it shows us that in the heart of man, everyone recognizes the Creator. They may not want to admit it. They may have suppressed that truth in their heart. But ultimately, everyone can recognize that there's a Creator because there's a creation. And it's so ironic to me that scientists, quote unquote, there's this perception of them as though they don't believe in God, which is kind of a misconception. But there is some truth to it. It's just interesting to me that would be the case, given that, you know, those of us who love science know the most about God's creation. I think we would be the ones with the least excuses when we stand before God, knowing what we know about the evidence of His hand in designing these molecular systems and these beautiful creatures that we see on the earth. Another interesting sort of analogy to kind of paint the picture here, if you've seen that Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns forces 1,000 monkeys to write all day on 1,000 typewriters. And they never produce anything worthy of note. And that's what nature is. It's just madness. And madness doesn't produce order and intelligent messages. You know, it might produce something that might be slightly organized, but it doesn't produce messages. Undirected madness does not produce order. And it definitely doesn't produce intelligent messages. And so messages come from messengers. Literally, we call it messenger RNA. DNA codes for messenger RNA. It is a message that tells your body how to build these intricately designed molecular machines. Thousands of them, millions of them, that regulate your body and keep your body alive. And it's not just your body, like the earliest known living things and the simplest living things have multiple proteins that regulate the life of that cell. You know, like another question, do computer programs come from randomness or do they come from computer programmers? If you follow a trail of intelligent information long enough, you're eventually going to find a mind behind that information. And the information we see in nature, I believe, is a clear evidence of the mind of God. And if you're an atheist, you have to kind of resort to, I'd say, really insufficient explanations for these things, like aliens or multiverse or critique the math or whatever it is, to kind of shrug off this glaring, massive problem of where the central dogma of biology that undergirds all of living things could come from. So this is just something that's been on my mind for about 8 years, and I've never actually talked about it publicly in this kind of sense on a podcast or Sunday school or whatever. And I think it's just really good evidence for intelligent design. You know, an information system that codes for molecular machines, it's all highly specialized, I think is really good evidence for a designer. And if you look at the simplest living organism on the planet, which some people would say is the mycoplasma, mycoides. Mycoplasma is extremely simple. It's basically got a membrane, it's got RNA, DNA, and then ribosomes and proteins. And that alone, and there's multiple, you know, multiple genes, multiple proteins, not just one each, but that alone, just a simple species like that, I think could not have arisen by natural processes. Now, there could be another theory that tries to explain where this came from, but I think natural processes is not a sufficient theory. And I hate to, you know, invoke supernaturalism, but I think that's the best explanation for the evidence that we have, is that a supernatural force or an intelligent designer did put together at once proteins and DNA. Because you can't have proteins without DNA, and DNA is meaningless if you don't have proteins. I mean, even if you got a meaningful DNA strand by itself, like a super highly, you know, specified information DNA strand that was going to code for a specific protein that had a function necessary for life, even if you get that DNA strand by chance, if it's not directly next to that functional protein, encapsulated by a membrane and having a lot of other factors involved at once, it's completely useless. And that DNA, if it doesn't have something like DNA polymerase to copy that DNA over time, is eventually going to unravel and degrade. You know, DNA has a shelf life. It's not going to last forever. That's why when we dig up, you know, species from the Jurassic period, we're not getting DNA strands that we can sequence because they've been dead so long. The DNA doesn't last that long. So then you have that combined probability problem of getting DNA and protein at once, and them being able to actually interact with each other. I mean, the chance of you even getting a single functional protein is ridiculously small, not much less getting one that actually specifically will interact with that strand to do some function necessary for the first living thing. And, you know, in this example, we used 150 amino acid strand protein. You know, some of the simplest proteins involved with life, or not even non-living things, like a protein involved with a bacteriophage, like a virus, will be 800, 900 amino acids long, which would be, 2,700 DNA nucleotides, which is, you know, makes those calculations a lot more improbable. So I think to get both of these things, proteins and DNA, to arise naturally together at once in the same place is virtually impossible. And that's kind of the idea I want to talk about today. So anyway, another thing too, I found this article. It's called The Sea's Missing Salt, A Dilemma for Evolutionists by Stephen Austin, who has a PhD, and he works at the Institute for Creation Research. And he basically, they looked at some flow models of inputs and outputs of sodium in the ocean and coming out of the ocean. And basically what they said was, if you look at a minimum input rate and a maximum output rate, it allows the maximum age of the ocean to be about 62 million years, which further shrinks this window of time for living things to evolve on the Earth, if this were true. But I think you don't even need to shrink that time scale down to 62 million years. You know, give it 400 billion years and you don't have near enough time to get a single protein by chance. So anyway, let's go to Twitter. So we're going to have our Twitter rant section. I've got some interesting interactions on Twitter lately I'd like to go to. Basically, we had a little conversation about evolution, and this person replied, and he said, That's an amazing take on evolution. Thanks for joining my Define Evolution Correctly Challenge. Can you correctly define the scientific term biological evolution in 1 to 2 sentences and then explain why it cannot occur? I will pay $500 if you can do both. And he's basically just being sarcastic and saying, you can't explain, basically talking down to us and saying, you don't even know what evolution is. And if you did, you definitely can explain how it cannot occur because obviously it does. So clearly he's not ready to pay us $500. But I think, you know, my response to him would be, obviously evolution does happen. And this is what drives me nuts about naturalists and diehard atheists that talk about this, is they blur the lines between microevolution and macroevolution. They use examples of small changes occurring, like beak finches and tiny things we can observe. And then they say, oh, evolution is true because of that. So, you know, us and chimpanzees share a common ancestor, or this and that, blah, blah, blah. Big changes. Yeah, obviously we came from lightning striking the ocean in the early Earth, because beaks of finches have changed a little bit in a few thousand years. It's okay, that's a big stretch. Okay, like obviously evolution's occurring. No serious person thinks evolution does not happen. The problem for critical thinkers is where do these things come from in the first place? Not how do you get different types of birds, how do you get birds? You know, how do you even get a single cell that has a single functional protein? Like that alone is, the probability is astronomical. And then someone else who would be friendly to science, faith, and reasoning said something that I do disagree with. She said, this is from Lisa Picanzo. She said, Hitler also used teachings on evolution to justify killing mentally and physically impaired humans, including children. The belief in the evolution doctrine spawns the most evil actions known to humanity. Your faith and devotion is impressive. And although maybe that's true, Hitler did believe in evolution and the superior race or whatever, but I don't like to just lump in all people who believe in evolution as though they're all going to want to kill mentally and physically impaired humans, or that it would even lead to that. I mean, maybe it can, or I guess it has in the past, but you know, people would say the same thing about Christians who did bad things, and they're like, see, they used the Bible to promote slavery or whatever. It's like, that doesn't mean the Bible teaches us to, it's not inherent in Christianity that slavery is to be done because Christians used Christianity to justify slavery. You know, that you can't just say because someone did something in the name of something that that represents that act. So anyway, I don't necessarily want to lump in all evolutionists, people who believe in macroevolution, because I do believe in microevolution, but I want to lump everyone who believes in macroevolution as people who want to, or who will in the future want to kill mentally and physically impaired humans. I think that, you know, that's not necessarily fair. Here's a new, this may be from someone who supports us here. This is just a few minutes ago since we started the podcast. He says, it's a straw man argument to say Christians don't believe in evolution with a big E. There are half a dozen different kinds of evolution I fully believe in. It's the one I don't that makes them pull the lighter out and set the scarecrow on fire. Excellent tweet. I'm retweeting that right now. Thank you, Chris Bullis. Yeah, and you know, that's what I'm saying. It's like clearly there are some forms of evolution that make sense, observable, testable, repeatable. But it's just these big stretches of like using that model to think that, you know, everything could have started from a naturalistic worldview. Clearly, that doesn't hold water to the evidence that we have. And I guess the last thing I would say is, you know, one of the biggest complaints I see with people complaining about what Christians say about this kind of stuff is they'll say, oh, because you don't know how it happened, that you're just saying God did it because you don't understand. As a God of the gaps type argument. That's not at all what I've been demonstrating this entire episode. What I'm saying is I know how the central dogma undergirds all of biology, and we know how it works. We know roughly how many nucleotides we would need to make a hypothetical small functional protein. We know exactly how that process works, and it's super complicated, and the probability of getting that by chance is zero, essentially zero. We can do the math, and we can say every single particle in the entire universe is going to attempt this, and they will fail. You know, it's kind of like, there's so many analogies I could say, but, you know, a tornado going through a junkyard isn't going to make a car. And the chances of that are probably higher than what we talked about today. So, I don't know. I mean, that's just, I think it's very unreasonable. We'll say it that way. It's very unreasonable to say that these things came about by chance. And I think it's very reasonable to believe that the evidence we have for the intelligent design of the central dogma that undergirds all living things was that the evidence of this points to an intelligent designer. Now, that doesn't mean that that intelligent designer is Jesus Christ, as I do believe that all things that have been made were made through Christ. I do believe that, but obviously the evidence doesn't point directly to Jesus. It points to a creator, but who that creator is another question altogether. So anyway, thanks for listening. I hope that made some sense, a little bit of sense for you. Please subscribe, like, you know, hit the notification bell. You can find us anywhere podcaster listens to. Stay tuned for the website that will be posted as soon as I can get it coded to a point that it doesn't look like complete crap, for lack of better words. And, you know, check out our Twitter page at SFR Daily for debates that I'll be having with different naturalists and evolutionists, and also maybe preaching to the choir a little bit for those Christians. So stay tuned. Peace.